This is Beyond Busy, the show where we talk about work and all the questions that define how and where we do that work. We talk about productivity, work-life balance, how people define happiness and success, and much, much more. If you're new here, my name is Graham Alcott. I'm your host for the show. I'm the author of How to Be a Productivity Ninja and the founder of Think Productive. And this week on the show, we're talking to David Marquet. David is the author of the best-selling book, Turn the Ship Around, has an amazing TED Talk with the same title, which we'll put a link to in the show notes. And is also the author of a new book, Leadership is Language. So we're going to talk in a second to David. This is a pre-lockdown conversation that we had earlier this year in London when he was over here for a few days. So just before we get into it, just to say, I hope you're enjoying the sunshine. It's a really lovely few days here in Brighton on the south coast of the UK. And also, if you haven't been following me and my Rev Up for the Week Sunday emails, you can find out more at grahamalcott.com, where you'll be able to get details of how to sign up from there. And the show notes for this episode and all the others are at getbeyondbusy.com. So let's get straight into the episode. This is a conversation about David's new book, Leadership is Language. Fascinating book about how language plays such a huge role in how we lead, and in fact, defines the style of how we lead. So we talk a lot about that. We talk about his time as the captain of a nuclear submarine in the US Navy, and much, much more. So I think you're going to really enjoy David. Really just charismatic, inspiring, interesting guy with so many wise things to say. So let's get straight into the episode. Here's my conversation with David Marquet. We've got about 40 minutes, I think.
Yeah, I'm doing another podcast in the hotel at 2.
Okay, so, cool.
Or at 1. And then I said, so I'm going to be like 2 minutes late, but I really need to, want him standing there wondering what happened.
And where are you based? Where do you live?
South of Tampa.
Okay. And so how long are you in London?
About a week. Been here for a couple of days. I was over Twickenham Friday. Did some stuff with the sports guys, the rugby guys.
Like with the English rugby?
Yeah. Eddie Jones was quoted as they asked him what he was reading, and he said, my book, Turn the Ship Around, my first book.
Yeah.
And so then all the rugby guys started reading my book. So it's been really fun.
Cool.
Yeah,
Did you know much about rugby before?
No, I don't know anything about rugby.
So it's like NFL, but without any clear idea of what's going on.
That's pretty much my feeling of that thing. I'm not in the dark. It's just how it is designed.
So I guess we're going to talk about two boats, basically, in this podcast. So we're going to talk about Santa Fe and El Faro.
Yeah.
And so your book is Leadership is Language, the hidden power of what you say and what you don't. I found it really fascinating, and essentially you're telling the story of this boat that sank, and some of the when you read this transcript, because they were able to dig up the transcripts from the bottom of the seabed essentially and kind of play back the recordings of what had happened on board and wrote that into a transcript. So you're kind of using this as an example of how language really affects your style of leadership, right?
It doesn't only affect it is your style of leadership. And so my background was submarine commander, and you really spend a lot of time paying attention to how exactly you say things. We did, and by some tweaks in the language. So for example, instead of saying I'd like permission to do this versus I intend to do this. And like what happens when you cascade that out at an organizational level? Another one is we, they. The team size is limited. It's limited at the we, they boundary, not what the org chart says. So when you say, well, tell me about these people. Well, we're in the marketing department. Well, how about them? Well, they're over in operations. So that's the team boundary, because I've heard the word change from we to they, because that means that's a different tribe. So we would say, well, just, and on submarine, we had a loose big tribe, but we had engineers and tacticians and officers and enlisted men. And so we had lots of mini tribes, and we just said, everyone's going to refer to everybody as we. If you don't, you get ignored. We won't, I'm not going to talk. I'm not going to wreck, which is awkward when someone's up there saying, well, they ordered the wrong part. And I would just not respond to that. And then someone say, hey, try saying we ordered the wrong part. And then they look silly and they walk away.
Yeah, all right.
But what happens is you rewire your brain. The action comes first. We act our way to new thinking, not think our way to new action. So that's so the genesis of the book was partially self-help, because I felt like, why am I asking questions in an unhelpful way? I want to ask questions that make it easy for people to share what they know. Yeah. But I would find myself saying, are you sure? Which is not easy to share, because you're never sure. Is it safe? Will it work? I don't know. But I have to say yes, or you're going to torpedo my project. Mm. But that doesn't leave the nuance of, well, I'm 99% sure, or I'm 51% sure. Yeah. And I lose all that nuance. We have a rush. We overly rush to reduce uncertainty and variability when we need to embrace variability. So thinking is an embrace variability sport. People apply reduced variability language. That's what I would see. The language is designed to reduce variability, and we rush into that. And the way you run meetings is designed to reduce variability. But thinking is an embrace variability sport. So the tagline is, we use a reduced variability playbook in an embrace variability game.
Mm. And let's come on and we'll talk about red work and blue work and the differences between those in a second. So one of the things that really interested me about the book is it felt like you shone a light over lots of the kind of subtexts to how people work and how people make decisions, like that whole thing of, like, you know, are you sure?
Right.
And
right.
It's like you kind of just have to say yes. So,
right.
So there's actually not just there's just no actual.
It's not really a question is it?
it's almost just like we've just.
We good here?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So
is there going to be a problem? No.
So it felt like when I read some of those parts of the book, it was like, it's so obvious how bad this style of communication is.
Yes. Right?
So did you feel like, so you had a particular experience, which you talk about in Turn the Ship Around, where basically, I mean, you can tell the story, but like you were trained to deal with one particular ship and then you got moved on to another ship and you had, so you're there having to sort of learn how to give orders on a vessel that you don't necessarily understand. Like, how quickly in that process did you start to really question some of those really basic fundamentals about how people delegate and how people lead in that kind of way?
So there was this nagging thought that there was going to be a problem, that I couldn't go and be the all-knowing commanding officer, which is, the system is designed for that. That's what we spent so much time. I spent 12 months learning everything. It's called knowing doing. And people tend to operate on the following axis. If I know it, I tell it, I give the team direction and we're off moving. It feels good for me. The team, like we're making product, whatever it is. If I don't know it, I say, okay, pause. Let's figure this out together. And those were the dimensions that I operated on. And but very quickly, with 2 weeks, I gave an order that couldn't be done. And in the past, like, if you come from that mindset of leader as decision maker mindset, then when you give a bad order, what you need to do is give better orders. That's the antidote to bad orders.
Right. Yeah.
But because of a complexity of a nuclear submarine, I was like, I can't, there's no way that can happen fast enough. So the problem isn't I gave a bad order. The problem is I was giving orders.
Mm.
And it turns out when the person at the top of the organization stops telling people what to do, brilliant things happen. Think about it. You have a gas pedal and a brake pedal. Now you just give up the gas pedal. You never use the gas pedal. Well, what's the the gas comes from the people. They're pushing forward. You're not having to provoke them. You're not having to prod them. You don't have to check on them. You don't have to do anything. You spend zero time managing people.
Mm.
They own it. Now, how you make that transition, though, is very dicey. You go too fast. It feels scary. It breaks. They just sit there looking at you. Nothing happens. So you have to sort of very gradually and safely move in that direction. And that's why we use the, but we did it by language. We're out running the ship. We don't have time to have, you know, an offsite or an away day. So we just said, hey, don't say request permission to, don't say, what do you want me to do? Say, just use these words, I intend to. Mm-hmm. We never talked about, quote, empowerment, but we had a structure for empowerment, which was, so basically it's like the thermometer on the wall. I can see what the temperature is, and then I can dial the temperature what I want. That's what, so when you take empowerment and make it real by saying that this sounds like this, we kept asking ourselves over and over again, Wisely, what would it sound like if? Oh, I want people to be collaborative. Okay, what would it sound like if people were more collaborative? Like, describe it. Well, you know, they would talk to you. No, specifically, what kind of word phrases? And so that's when.
Are you having these conversations on the ship?
Or yeah.
Having these, yeah.
Yeah, so all the time.
This isn't like a thing all, that you've prepared in advance. Or,
no, I had no idea. This was all panic and fear. And, you know, I was making this up on the fly.
And you don't get 2 days to or get off the ship and go and sit in a nice conference room somewhere.
No, because we own. No. See, that's the thing. We own the ship all the time.
Yeah.
you're so busy all the time. And when the ship comes into port, you know who fixes it? We do.
Yeah, right.
It's not like. Yeah. Being an airplane pilot where someone else goes and fix the air, we fix the ship. So there's this tremendous sense of time pressure, and we had to get the ship ready for deployment. And at the same time, we're changing our language. But the good thing is, it's very, very dense. I call it a closely coupled system. We're bouncing into each other all the time. And if I said something in the control room, very quickly, they would overhear. I talking to the engineer in the control room, people overhear, it bounces out and it kind of ripples out very quickly. And so I was able to reinforce through multiple interactions, the behaviors. But it all started with me. This is the other thing. So I got a couple things wrong. My initial reaction was, well, you guys need to be proactive. You need to step up. You need to, you're all screwed up. I'm fine.
Right.
Okay. And this is 180 degrees out of whack. I now believe that the reason that people say that is because they're lazy. They won't do the hard work of changing themselves. No. But you didn't tell me. Yeah, but guess what? As leaders, we didn't ask the question in a way that made it easy for you to tell me. Mm. You can only change your own behavior. Get that in your head. So you start with, well, I wish my team were more blank. Now, how do I change my behavior to make that easier?
Nice. Let's talk about how that then manifests itself. Because what was interesting is that there's this, I understood the thinking. I understood the, the shift. And I love that thing that you have talked about before, where it's like, move the decision-making to where the knowledge is. Move the authority to where the
knowledge is. Push the authority information. So the traditional thing is information gets channeled to the authority who makes the decision and comes back out.
Yeah. And then what it felt like was in this book, you're then putting that into a framework, which is based around the red work and blue work idea. So do you want to just really briefly explain red work versus blue work and how those two things are different?
So we use our brains in fundamentally two different ways. We work as traditionally defined. So imagine someone is talking to a client, running a process, running a nuclear power plant, flying an airplane, doing an operation, working on an assembly line, requires focus, which means I'm excluding. I'm deliberately limiting my perspective, so I'm just focusing on what I'm doing, because if I don't, I might get hurt, or there's variability in the work. I want all the holes drilled the same. I want the knife cut on the patient to be exactly, I don't want squiggly. Okay, so it's focus. But then the other kind of work we do is thinking, decision-making, contemplation, reflection, self-improvement. This requires a broad perspective, gathering new ideas, innovation, create. And so that's a fundamentally different way we use the brain. And for me, it's sort of like a head down into the work and then a head up. it's not what most people have is our head sort of in the middle all the time. So we're never really truly focused. We're never truly in the work. We're always reserving a little bit of our mental capacity to monitor ourselves. And then we're never truly broad. I did an activity the other day. So you're with a company, you're doing a workshop, you guys do these, and we have 30 executives, six tables of five, and the company says, I don't want everyone to sit with the normal people, I want to have maximum diversity at the table, so I've assigned the seats. So I said, well, there's a different way of doing it. I could just stand in front of the room and say, here's the deal, arrange yourselves in the most diverse manner. And we let them do that. Then we say, now explain how your table's diverse. And people come up with the most boring, well, we have different genders. We have different ethnicities. But people sometimes don't actually say that. And then we have, well, we have different backgrounds. And like, to me, this is like a scale of two in the level of diversity. And so there's so, like, humans are so diverse. And well, what kind of things do we, like, what TV shows do I watch? How many kids do I have? What languages do I speak? And even now I'm just scratching the surface. And so, but every once in a while, someone will say something. It's like, everyone's like, oh yeah, now I'm pushing it. But you don't get that until you risk letting them arrange their own. So when we broaden our horizons, we're not that broad.
Mm-hmm.
And when we run meetings where we talk about something and then we say, well, what does everyone think? Should we launch the product or not? And then everyone's nodding their head and they say, okay, well, y'all had a chance. You could have said something. The meeting is not really about making a decision. It's about giving the CEO the ability to say later, well, you all had a chance.
Mm.
If you really want people to make a decision, ask them first how strongly they feel about it and let them vote. Now you're looking for the strongest pro and con, and then you invite, we call it embrace the outlier.
Yeah,
we invite those people to have voice. The probability of someone who thinks quite differently to speak up just gets dampened down.
And that's because you've got the anchoring
and group thing. Yeah, right? Exactly.
So like if you've got particularly a senior person gives an answer,
yes,
and everybody else is kind of thinking, I think radically differently to that, but I better just give it a little bit differently to that rather than be too radical because I don't want to look too far out.
Right. So how many books should we print? First printing. And let's say, and it doesn't need to be, it could be anyone in the group. First one says, yeah, I think about 5,000.
Mm.
And you were thinking 20,000. So what do you say? Yeah, maybe 15.
Yeah.
So in other words, I've collapsed the variability.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if we say, okay, look, everyone write down on a card, what do you think the initial printing should be? And now I flip all the cards over and I see, oh, you have, so now I look for the high and the low. Oh, you wrote 1,000. Let's hear from you. You wrote 20,000. Like, what is it that you're saying that now you have a discussion.
Yeah, and then you're asking different questions.
Correct.
Right? So you're asking, what's the risk here? And
yeah,
like, how? Why are you really bullish on this or not bullish on this? Or
yeah, so a couple things. I like starting the question with what or how. Even why. So the way you said it sound to me pretty neutral. I would have been okay responding to that. But if you said, why are you so bullish on this?
Yeah.
Now you're sending a very subtle signal, not so subtle, that I'm not as bullish as you.
Mm,
so now right. there's a, I just yeah. put a little barrier, a little hurdle.
Yeah.
Now you have to overcome that hurdle. And depending upon the power gradients in the office, you may say, yeah, you know, yeah, you're right. Yeah, I'm off base. And then you just lost. You lost for the group of that one person thinking.
Yeah.
So the phrase we use is we're inadvertently and automatically, because it's just we're repeating what we've heard before, applying a reduced variability language
yeah.
to an embrace variability game. So then we have all these work, oh, we're going to have an away day, and this is brainstorming day, and idea meritocracy, we're going to call each other by our first names and whatever, and I'm not the CEO today. Well, that's just an admission that our normal meetings are run exactly opposite the idea of having creativity. Yeah, and I know you guys probably run into this a lot.
So it's like, yeah, we get to have one day off from the norm, but actually...
Right, now. Today you can be creative. Yeah. The other 364 days, just do what you're told.
So you've got this interface between the red work and the blue work. And
yeah.
So the red work is like the doing, the execution.
Yeah, I never answer the question.
And what you're trying to do is like in the doing part of it, what's interesting is in the doing part, you want to eliminate as much variability as possible and like,
yeah.
you know, because that gives you clarity, right? And then in the thinking part, you're trying to embrace variability as much as possible.
Yeah.
So how do those two things
yeah.
interface? Like, how do people transition from one to the other?
So it's very, so that's hard. The industrial age solved the problem by saying, okay, we're going to outsource those two different kinds of work to two different groups of people. One group, which we're going to call the white collar leadership, management, salaried people, are going to do the thinking or the blue work. Another group of people, which we're going to call workers, labor, unionized, hourly people, are going to do the doing work. So the deciders choose what the doers are going to do. And the problem is now, or the challenge now is, first of all, that's a terrible life. If you just get told what to do all the time. But it's this phase we've gone through with the Industrial Revolution. Now what I think we want is we need the doers. We want the doers to be the deciders. Let the doers be the deciders. Mm. So, which is actually all of us. So the people doing the work should be able to make decisions about the work to as much as possible. But what that means is that this group which hitherto just said, do what you're told, have a narrow focus. Now I need to oscillate. So I need narrow. Monday through Thursday, narrow. Then Friday, we're going to back up. We're going to have a broad focus.
Mm.
That's the hard part. That's where we need to be agile. So we need to make it easier to stop. Hey, we've been so good chopping down these trees, so good printing, doing print films, so good renting DVDs that we just keep doing it. No, we're going to put time out. Now we're going to think about it. But you also have to make it easy to get, okay, enough thinking, enough contemplation, enough, now let's get back into the doing.
Yeah.
So both ways, we see organizations stuck on both sides.
Yeah, so do you have advice for organizations if you feel like an organization is stuck too much in doing and they're not, and this would be the sort of the classic sort of stories of, you know, Kodak, not embracing yeah. digital photography and various others and Blockbuster Video and all that. So like, if you're stuck in that cycle of doing and you're not necessarily, you know, thinking about the broader picture,
right.
how do companies break out of that and vice versa?
So at the strategic level, your strategy should be a hypothesis. It shouldn't be, here's our plan, period. It should be, our hypothesis is that if we do this, we're going to have these outcomes. And then what are we going to learn? And then there should be expiration dates. So every time you make a decision, put an expiration date on it. So we're going to decide to do print film. We're going to decide to do streaming video. We're going to decide to make a new app, whatever. And in 6 months, we're going to reevaluate. So you want to put a marker in the calendar to pause and raise your head. Because once you get going, you'll be so happy and you'll be so good at it. But it might be irrelevant for the marketplace. At the sort of operation, like quarterly goals, companies often write quarterly goals, but we say, how about what are we going to learn this quarter? So, oh, we're going to do this. We're going to raise revenue. We're going to ship this product. But rarely do I see. And we have a deliberate plan to learn more about ABC. You look at Bezos's first annual report for Amazon back in 98. He writes, this is what we've achieved, and we have much to learn about internet selling things on the internet. Right. And he talks about it. In the meantime, I got Jack Welch's GE report. It's all hubris, and this is what we've done. And there's nothing in there about, and here's what we have to learn more about.
Yeah.
And now look what happened. At the time, I don't know, you know, obviously Amazon was a pipsqueak and GE was a giant. Now, see what happens.
But then it's also, so coming back to that thing I was saying before about you're shining a light really on some of the games that sort of the subtext games that are played, right? So the subtext game of that is, look at how great we are, so yeah. that the share, because the game is instill confidence amongst shareholders. And actually, you know, that approach doesn't serve innovation or thinking differently or embracing any kind of vulnerability, basically, is like a
exactly
thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I call that, and by the way, I don't think it actually instills confidence. I don't think anyone's tricked by some braggadocio, or maybe they were, but
I think many people are.
Okay, all right. Well, that'll be podcast number two. Yeah, maybe you're right. I take it back. But I guess they wouldn't say if it didn't work. But here's the deal. I call that your be good self.
Yeah.
And it happens at a corporate level, it happens at individuals. And the idea is, I got to protect this image that we're good and that I deserve my salary, I shouldn't be fired. And it really gets down to that. Like, I'm afraid.
Mm.
And the problem is, the be good self is resistant to admitting that we could be better, seeking feedback, which is what we need if we're going to play the long game and say, oh, well, 3 years from now, do we want to be doing exactly the same as we're doing? No, we should be interacting with clients better than. Yeah. Well, that means at some point we need to say we can do it better than what we did. Oh, but the problem is now for the doers or the deciders, it was us who chose it to be that way. So now I'm having to question myself.
Mm.
And I have to rethink decisions that we made. And that only comes from a safe environment. And this is so anathema. As I was a nuclear submarine commander, the whole thing was about scaring the shit out of people. Yeah. We got a nuclear reactor. We got enemies trying to kill us. It's tense, dicey stuff. It is physically, there are physical dangers, but we would then perpetuate emotional scariness on our people.
Mm.
And you don't have to. You don't provoke people into being brilliant and being great. People are great. No act of greatness, I don't think, was because someone was ordered to be great. I have yet to read about it.
And this really comes back to like the central premise with, you know, in the book where you're talking about El Faro and the sinking of that boat. So you're talking about how... There's one bit that I really liked. You know, you were just saying there about decisions should be time limited.
Yeah.
And you talk about here was the script for the particular decision to take the boat in this particular direction.
Yeah.
And then you say what they could have said is, let's move in this way. I'm not 100% certain of this, so I'm going to review this decision at 12 o'clock, continue until 12, and I'll be back just before then. And actually... the longer the situation went on, it's like everyone's entrenched in the authority and the decision is to move this way.
Right.
And so everyone's entrenched in that. And it's like it almost becomes this thing of you've got to keep proving you're right by steering through the most dicey.
Yeah, so that's called escalation of commitment, because I'm getting more and more invested in proving I'm right. But the other thing is, a deviation is just, it feels like when I get to a fork in the road, they're not equally weighted. They don't play with equal on an equal playing field. It's like, unless you prove that we ought to turn, we're going to keep going straight. And the play, I call it the framework of the book is the six plays that we, and so the play from the industrial age is continue, because you want to run the production line as long as possible, because there's big costs of retooling and downtime. Downtime is a very visible, I see it on the balance sheet, on the income statement, as waste. Eliminate that. So there's a huge burden to being the person who says, hold on, I'm not sure that this is right.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's wrong. You don't need that. Yeah. I just need to be, I'm not sure that it's right. There's a huge, and when we talk about that with people, they say, well, people don't want to be wrong. Well, why are we calling it that? we could call it, well, that's resilience. Raising your hand and pausing the assembly line and double checking. I could use the phrase resilience, but we don't. Everyone calls it wrong. So the new play is called complete. Think of the work in chunks. Let's complete it. So complete it lets us truly reflect on how we're doing. But the other thing complete lets us do is celebrate.
Yeah.
If every day feels the same, we're just churn, there's no pause, there's no celebration, no sense of progress, no fun.
So complete is about committing to, you know, breaking something down and then committing to the first stage of that, then committing to the next stage of that and kind of looking at those things as...
Right. And that's the other part of it, is because the commitment is shorter. It's not like, oh, we're going to do an initiative and for the end of time, we're going to do this, which feels very heavy. It's, hey, let's run an experiment for the next 3 months. We're going to... when we talk to our client, I'm trying to picture something and kind of the work that we're doing. When we talk to our clients, we're going to do an in-person visit. Mm-hmm. Well, that'll cost more, but we'll learn more. So does it? And our hypothesis is it'll pay off in the long run. So maybe 3 months might not be long enough. But you say, okay, so for 6 months, 3 months, a year, whatever, we're going to try it. And the benefit of that, multiple benefits, but another one is that it activates people's senses. If you say, no, the new process has changed, we're now doing these in-person intake sessions, they're like, okay, that's what we're doing. But if you say, look, we're going to try it for 6 months, and then we're going to talk about what we learned, as they're doing the new process, their eyes are looking left and right, and they're saying, okay, how could this be better? Oh, yeah. I can see how this is messed up. That's exactly what you want.
And because you're labeling it as an experiment, right? So
exactly.
Straight away, there's like a softness to that. There's like more of a permission to that.
Permission to fail.
Yeah.
And it's an experiment. And so you learn.
Yeah. And one of the other things that I really loved was, so you talk about control the clock, not operate the clock. I'd love you to tell us how that could have stopped La La Land from being good the best Oscar. Do you want to just tell that story?
Yeah, so we just had the Oscars 3 years ago. Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway, it was the 50th anniversary of Bonnie and Clyde. They were there to announce the most prestigious, the final award of the evening, the award of Best Picture, which was awarded to Moonlight. They come on stage, they have the envelope. They've been incorrectly handed the wrong envelope. The envelope they've been handed was for the second to last award, Best Actress, Emma Stone, La La Land. So the card says Emma Stone, La La Land, and at the bottom of it, it says Best Actress in small letters. And now, as luck would have it, La La Land was a nominee. So they get on stage, and Warren opens the envelope. He pulls out the card, he looks at it. He looks at it again. He checks the envelope for a second card. His brow is furrowed. His head is looking down. He looks left and right. He kind of looks off stage. There's nothing. He looks again in the envelope. Faye now is getting exasperated. She says, come on. Then you're impossible. He shows it to her.
So the subtext at this point is that the idea of a pause in the middle of the most prestigious bit of the Oscars.
Yes.
It's terrifying.
It's terrifying.
Right?
But on the other hand, okay, so, and then so she announces it, La La Land, which is wrong. Yeah. It's supposed to be Moonlight, and it's very awkward after that. But it's a lot, and people say, well, why can't he just do a little timeout signal? No one is shooting at you. You have no nuclear reactors to worry about. It's just people. So on the one hand, I kind of can make light of it is based on my experience dealing with, quote, real things, but it feels very real. I mean, social ostracism and feeling wrong. Well, so what's happening is it's the pressure of the clock, which is causing his prefrontal cortex to shut down. And his reptile brain is in charge at that moment. His reptile brain wants self-preservation. It doesn't want to look bad. If I'm the one who calls time out, it's going to be me. On the meantime, if I just let it go, Faye's going to read it. PwC gave it to me. There's sort of this diffuse and no... People will know he hesitated because it's visual, but oftentimes it worked. We will never know that you saw something and you could have said something, but you're never 100% sure that's a problem.
Yeah.
And so you got to make a decision, and we lose it. So many times we've had tragedies where afterwards we found out that a sailor or a person saw something or heard something and didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. And there's the tendency to blame them and say, well, you know, you need to speak up more, and you're going to go to train. We're going to send you to assertiveness training.
And it's like they should have blown the whistle, or they should have been the heroic, whatever, right?
But we've structured the system where calling a pause is very difficult. Yeah. So what you want, that's called a bang the clock. That's why we have words like clock, right? And this comes directly from the industrial age. So you want to control the clock. You want to give the team the ability to say pause. This is exactly what the Toyota production system and Encore does.
Yeah.
And as a leader, when you see the team hesitating, our instinct is, no, let's get going. We're burning daylight.
So the and Encore just explained, so you've got a production line.
Yeah.
And it's like someone recognizes something's not quite right.
Right.
And the andon cord, andon is like the Japanese lantern, right? So like when you pull this cord, the lantern lights up, and then somebody else in the building knows, hang on, there's a problem over there.
Right.
You need to go and check that out.
Exactly. So it's a way for them to signal.
Yeah.
I was in red work. I was in production work. I was focused, but I have to shift to a different mode of work, which is now I'm in problem solving. Mm. I need to think and solve the problem. And if necessary, if I can't solve the problem in the amount of time that the part is on my part of the assembly line, then we'll stop the whole line.
Mm.
If the supervisor comes over, the first words out of the supervisor's mouth, by the way, thank you. Not, you again?
Yeah, right.
Really?
Yeah. So again, you're creating that environment, you're creating the culture where that feels like the more natural, less risky thing to do.
Right.
Rather than I'm the one putting my hand up and wrecking the production statistics or whatever.
Yeah. So how many times does that button get pushed a week? If it only gets pushed once, then it's going to feel scary.
Okay.
Apparently, it gets pushed like 1,000 times a week in a factory.
Really?
Yeah, it's a huge number. So,
like, actually 1,000 times, or
Someone was telling me this. I couldn't validate it, but it's pushed a lot of times, which demystifies the whole. It's not. So, in other words, in that culture, if someone from Toyota were running the Oscars and standing there instead of Warren Beatty, they would just would have said and Encore.
Yeah, right.
Because it's demystified. It's not scary.
Yeah, you mentioned something there, a couple of things just before we wrap up I'd love to talk about. So you talked at the beginning about you kind of partly wrote the book as a self-help kind of thing for you. So let's talk about that. And then I want to also just talk about the other thing you just mentioned there, which is like, you know, the Oscars is, you know, it's scary to hold your hand up in that situation, but like you're on a nuclear submarine doing like real stressful stuff, so I'd love to learn a bit more about that in a minute.
Yeah,
but the idea of a self-help book for you and thinking about language and thinking about that, so obviously like with Santa Fe and the story, that we'll put the link in the show notes to that little animation video that kind of tells that story, so people can kind of really kind of go through that if they've not read Turn the Ship Around. But when you started to write that book, like what were the most powerful words or the most powerful changes in language that as you were working, you know, and as the commander of a ship, you found just made the biggest change? And what can people take away from that in terms of management and leadership and the work they're doing?
So I would just, if I could start the sentence right, I would be on the right track. So for example, my questions tended to be overly binary. Is it, will it work? Are we ready? And I wanted it to be. So I said, if I start the question with the word how, so it wasn't don't ask binary questions. It was start the question with how ready are we? How likely is it? How likely is this to be the actual enemy? And another one was I wanted people to understand that there was uncertainty in my mind, because in combat, the enemy is deliberately trying to spoof you and hide you and trick and that kind of stuff. So I would say, what I'm worried about the thing that keeps me up at night, where what I'm unsure or and that kind of thing. And then I also found myself saying at the end of I'd give a little talk. Okay, I'd sum up. Okay, here's the plan. Here's what we've talked. Here's the plan. Da, 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 da. Does that make sense? Mm. Well, even that makes the easy path just this head nod. But then I'd find out later, you know, I wasn't really confused. I said, but I asked, said, does that make sense? But no, that's not really a thing.
So yeah, I say that all the time. That's a real, like, does that make sense? Just at the end of
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to say was, what was unclear?
Yeah.
What am I missing? How could we be wrong? And so what happened is I started with this like long list. Here's another one. You say the world the way you experience it. Someone says, you miss a meeting, you're embarrassed. And someone says, well, there was an email on it. You don't remember seeing it, but what you say is, well, you didn't send it to me. Mm-hmm. But you don't know that. You don't know that. So then you say, well, I didn't see it, which you also probably don't know. You don't remember seeing it. So, because if you just say the world the way you experience it, I don't remember seeing. Sorry, I just don't remember seeing it. No one can argue with you. Mm. You didn't send it to me. Yes, I didn't know you. That's fruitful. So there's this long list. Don't say this, say that. But you can't remember that. So there has to be a structure. And so must be a structure. And so the way I think about it is you kind of lower the water. When the tide goes out, you see the way the rock, the patterns of the rocks. And so we lower the water. And the most overriding structure is the structure between doing language and thinking language. And then the more nuanced structure are these six plays. And then and we talked about a couple, instead of obey the clock, control the clock, instead of continue, connect. And the final one is instead of conform to role, instead of continue, complete.
Yeah.
Instead of conforming to role, connect as human beings. But there's six of them.
And I love improve, not prove as well. Can you just explain that one?
Well, the idea is, we talked about the get better mindset versus the be good. And the idea is, if you're a doing mode, doing always invokes proving. Okay, I got to prove that I can do it. Mm. Versus learning is an improve idea. So if it's an experiment hypothesis, then what we're invoking is the mindset of improvement. You want to have a learning. CEOs tell me all the time, oh, I'd like to have a learning organization. But we then run it in a way where everyone has to prove themselves. Well, if you always have to prove yourself, it gets in the way of learning.
Yeah, and I'm going to be in so much trouble if I don't let you go.
Okay.
But can you just give us a couple of words? What's the difference now in your lifestyle between that high pressure, commander of a submarine versus what you do these days?
Well, I go on stage, I do lots of keynotes. So there's no reason why a submarine commander should be any good at doing keynotes. So when I started, it was great because there were no expectations. And so I just had fun. And then people started paying me. And then I had a lot of pressure. But I've kind of come through that. And the best ones are when it's sort of a light and slightly experiment. Hey, I'm going to try some stuff. And I tell the audience, trying a little new structure with you guys. So tell me at the end how you like the structure. You can't just say, oh, how'd you like it? It's too vague. But or you say, I, this section here is new. Let me know how it resonates with you. How useful was it? And you get better at asking the question so you get the information that's most, that helps you get better.
What I love is you're taking that mindset that you've talked about with Turn the Ship Around into your own keynotes and into your own work, right? And sort of leading yourself in that way, which is fascinating. I could talk to you for hours and I'm really worried about being in trouble. So I'm going to wrap it up.
All right. Well,
So the book is Leadership is Language. Do you want to just say how people can get a hold of you and find out more about what you do?
Yeah, I'm on social media, L. David Marquet. Most social media goes LinkedIn. And we have a website, my name, and Intent-Based Leadership. That's the name of our program. And we have a cool program called Leadership Nudges, which are little one-minute videos.
Yeah.
And there were like three, we're almost 300 now on YouTube. So go to YouTube, type in Leadership Nudges. And there's just little nuggets like, you know, start the question with how and stuff like that. It's not heavy. And we try and keep them.
I'll put a link to a couple of those. The one with the toilet thing.
Yeah. That was one. Really cool. I was in Scotland for that. I was like, oh my gosh, look at this amazing.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for being on Beyond Busy. And good luck with the rest of the trip. Thanks again.
Cheers.
So there you go. Really recommend Leadership is Language and also Turn the Ship Around. Two really great books and some good stuff on TED and elsewhere. If you don't have time to read the whole book, but you want to kind of get a little bit more of David's stuff. And also really recommend his little leadership short things that he puts out on YouTube. Really fun, interesting little set of videos as well. Just a couple of quick thank yous from me. So thanks to Mark Stedman and Podient, our producer and platform for this show. And thanks also to Think Productive, our sponsors for the show. We run productivity training and workshops and coaching and all kinds of stuff that can really help you and your team. So head to thinkproductive.com if you want to find out more about that. And we're going to be back in 2 weeks' time. We have some really great episodes already in the can lined up coming out over the next few weeks. So we'll see you in two. And until then, enjoy the summer. Take care. Bye for now.